Hello and welcome to the third season of Somerset Stories, the podcast which explores the lives of the people who live, work and create in Somerset. My name is Lewis Webb and each week I get to share the stories of some of the inspiring, creative and successful individuals and families that make this beautiful county their home. As ever, your comments, reviews and feedback are always appreciated. And if you'd like to send us a message, you can email hello@somersetstories.com. This season, we'll also be showcasing some of the area's musical talent, with tracks from local artists being played in each podcast. My guest this week is the young man with the old soul, Marvin Monacay. Marvin's a jazz singer and composer who's made his home in Weston-super-Mare. Influenced by the likes of Sinatra, Nat King Cole and Tony Bennett, Marvin's music has seen him perform on The Voice and make it to the semi-finals of Britain's Got Talent. More locally, he's graced many stages around Somerset, including the Western Playhouse, produced three albums in the last 12 months, and streamed his music live over social media through lockdown. Marvin, welcome back to Somerset Stories.
Thank you for having me back, Lewis. It's great to be back. Thank you.
How is Weston today?
Weston today was on the dry side. We had outbreaks of sunshine, which was very nice. I went for a walk shortly before coming on here this evening. It was lovely. The tide was in, the air was fresh, the sun was going down onto the sea. Oh, it was really nice, very beautiful.
Sounds stunning. It's sort of proper spring weather at the moment.
Spring is in the air, absolutely. Spring is my favorite season of the year because it shows to me a new start, you know, a new awakening of life and, you know, things coming to life again after the winter and the cold weather and the plants growing and the trees blossoming. I don't know if you've ever been to Weston. There's a fantastic street that looks so lovely in the spring. It's called the Boulevard. And there's like on both sides of the road, there's a lovely sort of row of trees that in the spring, they're like cherry blossom trees. So you're just walking down the road and it's just like just pink everywhere. It's really, really nice.
Somerset is your home now.
It is, yeah.
You've been here about six or seven years, something like that.
It'll be seven years in September. Time has flown by, seriously.
But you grew up in London.
That was right. So I was born and raised in the East End of London.
So to give people an idea of, because East London, I'm not sure people will know exactly where. So what was close nearby? Is it sort of Olympic Park?
Yeah.
That kind of area?
Yeah, so I was born in the borough of Newham. Or some people say Newham. It was actually originally part of Essex, actually, until 1965, when Greater London was created. So it was a merger of two boroughs, the borough of East Ham and the borough of West Ham. And I was born in the former borough of West Ham in a hospital called Plaistow Hospital. And we moved around quite a bit. So we moved down to Stratford, where the Olympic Park is now. But before then, it was a pretty run-down area. So the Olympics was the best thing to happen to Stratford. And then when I grew up, a few years later, we moved to a town called Beckton by the Dockland area.
Down by the airport, right?
Yeah, by the city airport. Not too far from there, just about like a 5-minute drive or like a 10-minute journey on the bus.
Were you sort of the performer of the family, even from an early age, like amongst your siblings?
Well, I had my moments. The folks from my local church used to call me the quiet performer because I was very quiet back then, like extremely quiet. I didn't really say much, you know. It was always like, you know, speak when you're spoken to or like be seen and not heard and that sort of thing, you know. But I did have my moments just clowning around or like, you know, playing my old drum set that my parents bought for me one Christmas until that sort of snapped apart.
That's quite brave of your parents to buy a drum kit for Christmas.
They did, yeah, yeah. It was great. It was I was drumming upstairs and then, you know, one day after another, things got lost and it just fell apart, sadly. We had to give it up. But music has been deeply rooted in my family for generations. I should say, my paternal grandfather, Maurice, he was once a chorister and also a war veteran. He served in the Biafra War, more commonly known as the Nigerian Civil War, in the late 60s. He's late now, but I didn't have the chance to meet him. Very, very wonderful person. We would speak over the phone for several years, and when I finally met him, it was a very emotional, but it was a very nice, a nice set of emotions, actually.
Yeah.
And then my maternal grandfather, James, he was a professional singer. He's retired now, still going strong. He'll be 88 this year. He played in venues across the Southwest, including Devon and Cornwall, and in several variety competitions where he often won first place. In fact, every other year he took a part in these competitions, he won first place. And then the next year afterwards, his daughter, my auntie, knocks him into second place, which I thought was hilarious.
Were they classical musicians, jazz musicians? What kind of music were they performing?
Well, my grandfather was an Anglican, so he was very much into the hymns. So he sang like songs like Onward Christian Soldier, Marching On to War. So, you know the usual Anglican hymns. And then my grandfather, on my mother's side, he was into a bit of everything, a bit of soul, jazz. He was very much into his country as well. Very much into his country. I remember on one of his birthdays, my mum sent me a video of him riding around in his mobility scooter in like this red leather cowboy outfit, which I thought was hilarious. And he loves his John Wayne as well.
So was it a sort of musical house that you grew up in then? Did music play a big part of, you know, a typical weekend? What was on the radio and the CD player?
Yes. Yeah, so my father, he wanted to be a musician himself back in the day, and sadly that dream was never realized. But he loved his music. I remember growing up, growing up in the house, we had this huge like hi-fi stereo system with speakers like dotted everywhere in the living room, and sometimes we'd get a bit scary. Do you remember that THX sound that used to come on? That used to scare me as a child, you know. Seriously.
Make the house move.
It felt like that the house was about to fall down for me. It was horrible. Every time I heard it, I ran upstairs. And my dad would be like, "Marvin, why are you running upstairs for? What's wrong with you?" I don't like that sound. You know that sound that goes... Oh, it was horrible. I can just about handle it now, but there were some traumatic memories growing up hearing that sound, especially on the big... huge hi-fi stereo system. It was crazy. But he was into his Bob Marley and Fela Kuti and a lot of Marvin Gaye as well. Marvin Gaye as the person, the legendary artist who I was named after.
Is that true?
Yeah, I was named after Marvin Gaye. Yeah, you don't get a lot of Marvins nowadays.
Not really.
No, Marvin's right. Marvin's a rare one nowadays. I don't know why.
So you had a lot of different musical influences going on back then.
Yeah.
How did you first get into singing?
So there is a story that sort of leads up to that. In the singing side of things, I spoke about my two grandfathers, but my mother also was a singer as well. She sang in her choir as well back in her youth. And she used to sing in the choir in the church that I grew up in too. And my eldest brother was a gospel music producer. And he still writes songs nowadays, and he used to lead one of the church choirs too. And he was very much into his music production. So one of the huge things that he had that he shared with all of us was this very, very huge keyboard. And the reason why I'm saying that was because when I was growing up then, I was mesmerized by that the classic cartoons of Looney Tunes and Tom and Jerry. Not only because they were hilarious and beautifully animated, but because of the cleverly written and performed like jazz orchestrations as well, by the likes of Carl Stalling and Milt Franklin and Scott Bradley. Their unique blends of jazz and popular music that accompanied these cartoons were nothing short of genius. So it wasn't until I reached my teens that I realized that the key ingredient of the success of those scores was jazz. And I soon began to discover the work of Jelly Roll Morton, Benny Goodman, Cab Calloway, Fletcher Henderson. I then joined my school jazz band as the pianist for a year. And then I made my first solo performance as a jazz singer at the age of 16. Now, I'd been singing on and off since the age of six. My earliest memory of singing was, again, in the church on Easter Sunday, singing "This Little Light of Mine, I'm Gonna Let It Shine. This Little Light of Mine, I'm Gonna Let It Shine." But, yeah.
I was going to touch on that, actually, because I know you sort of did a bit of singing in church pre your baritone voice.
Yes.
And, of course, as a boy, you know, you have probably had a slightly higher voice than you do now.
Yes, I did have a high voice. I used to pride myself on the I used to go higher on the harmonies as well.
Yeah.
And then, obviously, puberty came.
Yeah. Do you remember your voice breaking? And do you remember how it kind of affected you? Were you?
I do actually. I was 11. Oh no, I was, yes, I was 10, because I used to go around like the youth clubs and just around church or just seeing people, and I would tell them my age. I'm 10 years old, and they would tell me, "God, your voice is deep." And I started to notice it myself. Like, there were some songs I couldn't sing in the high register like I used to do previously. And by the age of 11, it began to break even more. And I just hid away from singing for a while, primarily because I was getting bullied as well. So I thought, you know, it shook my confidence quite a lot.
With the singing originally being from church and from kind of those sort of, as you say, the hymns and the gospel melodies, did you take in what you were singing about? Was it more than just enjoying the music?
Oh, I did. As a Christian myself, I didn't really come to faith until I was 11. Even when I was singing in the congregation, you know, those songs that always struck a chord with me, and always spoke to me, and what was on my mind, and it gave me a bit of a resting place.
Your album is called "The Young Man with the Old Soul."
Yes,
and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But that's kind of how you describe yourself. Was the sort of discovery of jazz, was that something that unlocked part of your identity, like a calling that you sort of realized that you had?
I'm glad you said calling, because I think, now that I think about it, I think it was my calling to be a jazz singer in particular. And again, going back to my voice breaking at an early age, later on, like a year or two later, I was able to use that to my advantage. And that's when I discovered the likes of Frank Sinatra and Nat King Cole and Gregory Porter, all who had such beautiful, deep voices. And I thought, you know what, there is hope. There is an audience for this sort of voice. And it's not always about high altos and sopranos. So when I did my first vocal performance at the age of 16, it was Frank Sinatra's version of "Fly Me to the Moon." And I remember how I felt. It was part of a competition for children in need. And we were raising money for that charity at school. And the first prize was 17 paintball tickets. And I won that, one of the very first competitions I won. And sadly, they all expired before I was able to use them.
How different was it kind of performing to an audience, as in, you know, getting up there and singing to an audience, instead of singing as part of a choir in a church where, you know, you're not really, it's not a performance. It's like, that's an act of worship, right, in a church. But when you stand up on stage and you sing jazz, it's to an audience because, you know, you want to entertain them. Did that come naturally to you?
I was able to use some of that, use some of what I've learned from singing in choirs to apply to my vocal technique. But in terms of stage presence, there are two polar opposites. So when you're singing in the choir, you're not singing for yourself. You're not singing, the spotlight's not on you. You know, you're singing your praises to God, or, you know, whatever God, you know, you want to worship. And that's side of things. But then when you're singing on your own to an audience, the spotlight is on you. And suddenly they're not just looking for the voice. They're looking for the way you engage with the crowd, the way you connect with the crowd. And that takes, some people, you know, discover it automatically, and that's great. But I think if you want to have a lasting effect on your audience, it's something that you continually develop, and it's something that you don't get cocky with. It's something that you just, you always reinvent and develop and re-innovate as well. For example, these we'll probably talk about this later. The live stream shows that I've been doing since the start of lockdown, Melly Time with Marvin. Although it's been quite hard at times, not singing to a crowd, it's been great to connect with my fans and friends and family virtually, and still get some practice in as well. Singing different songs, singing new songs, practicing new material, working my way, speaking between songs, practicing my stage presence and my diction and everything. So it all really helps, really.
And when you started doing that, how did that kind of affect your confidence? Because you mentioned earlier that, you'd been through bullying.
Yeah.
And so was kind of getting up on stage and performing, did that do anything to start rebuilding your confidence?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And I'm glad it did. Music was one of the only things, if not the only thing, growing up that really healed the suffering that I went through as a child in school. And yeah, all of a sudden, from that night, doing my first performance, a lot of the people that bullied me started respecting me, and all of a sudden I was like, the king of the hill in my year group, which was quite surreal at first, to be honest with you, but it was very nice at the same time.
I would imagine that not many of your classmates would be as into that style of music.
Yes.
So it's probably something that was a little bit new to them.
Yes, it was. And it's again, some people were a bit immature about it as well, or saying, oh, jazz is boring, it's all about Lady Gaga, and to each their own. What I was trying to do was to show to people that, everyone has different tastes, and they might not, align with, the current popular tastes of music, but that doesn't make you any less of a person. It just makes you you. And over the years, I've learned to embrace myself as who I am as a person and who I am as an artist. And if you don't like what I hear, what I've got to offer, that's fine. But I know there is an audience out there, and I think it's very important to keep this light of jazz, burning for the future generations.
It's such a challenging time of, a young adult's life, that kind of 15, 16, 17, where you're really trying to establish, who is it that you are, and kind of what's the type of person that you're going to be, and where are you heading?
Yeah.
Music and kind of being able to perform and show sort of excellence in that is such a good framework, I suppose, for navigating adolescence.
Yes, if it wasn't for music, if it wasn't for the opportunity I had to showcase my talents like this and such on this platform, I don't know where I would have been, to be honest with you. I probably wouldn't be here speaking to you right now.
Are you still in touch with some of your friends from that time?
Very, very few, and it's very, very rare nowadays. I really thought that, once we all finished, they all said, oh yes, keep in touch. And then when we all dispersed, some of them I kept in touch with, but then that gradually got smaller and smaller and smaller, sadly. It just happens. That's just life. But, I wish no harm on them, even the ones who bullied me, I know a lot of them are regretting it right now, but hey ho.
Yeah, it's really hard when you're the victim of bullying to realize it, but the act of bullying comes from a place of such insecurity and self-doubt that those people are probably struggling you know, equally, if not more than a lot of their victims. Absolutely. It's quite sad.
There's something that I read today. It was just a quote on social media. It said, haters don't really hate you. They see a reflection of what they want to be in you. And so that's what makes them hate. That's what makes them angry. Is that they want to be you. They see the success that you've made. And they want a piece of that, but they don't know how to get there. And so that the only thing they can do is criticize.
When did you realize that you wanted to kind of take this seriously and try and build a career in music?
It was instantly after that first performance, actually. It opened a new world. It opened a new world to me. And it was soon after I then started researching Nat King Cole and Ella Fitzgerald and Pearl Bailey, Dinah Washington, Harry Connick Jr., Michael Bublé, Jamie Cullum, Herbie Hancock, all these great artists, classic and contemporary. Now, at first, when I told my parents that I wanted to pursue music, they were a bit hesitant. You know, it's just parents being protective. You know, they obviously parents want what's best for their children. Any normal parent does. But then sometimes, you know, you probably know how it is. They think they know what's best. And then they try and set you on another path. But I had to stand my ground. I said, no, this is what I want to do. But I do remember, though, the very first time, I was so excited after that performance. The opportunity came up to actually go on Britain's Got Talent for the very first time. And they were holding auditions at the Excel Centre in London. And I can remember, because I was waiting in the queue to come in. And it wasn't the actual audition with in front of the judges, the ones that you see on TV. But it was, there was a camera and there was like the producers all sat there in the row on chairs and tables. And I sang Fly Me to the Moon. And they said, thank you very much for your audition. We'll let you know in the post if you got through to the TV audition. And I waited and I waited and I checked every single letter that came in the post for about 4 or 5 weeks. I then knew that that was not meant to be. And then about 2 years later, I auditioned again. This time it was at the Emirates Stadium in Highbury, where, you know, my family naturally support Arsenal.
Of course.
So,
good man.
So that was, I don't know, man. I'm getting annoyed with them though. I must confess, but hey,
part of the fun.
So yes, I auditioned there for another series of BGT. And I sang A Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square, which was the very same song that I sang for my music GCSE. It's a beautiful, beautiful song, and was still one of my favourites. And again, it was a no. So yeah, all these things really happened. I guess it was the fates that be saying that, Marvin, it's not your time yet. It's not your time.
Mm. Well, of course, because a lot of people might not realise this, but with male voices, when they break and you sort of develop, you know, your new baritone or bass or tenor or whatever you end up being, it takes a long time for that to mature and reach its full potential.
Absolutely.
So, you know, when you look at jazz performers, opera singers, they're often their best work is a lot later in life. It's not one of these things that, like, you're better at it because you're young. It's not like sports.
Yes.
Where you get worse.
Yeah.
It's like the opposite. You know, you get better with age.
I soon realized that, definitely. My voice now, how it sounds now, sounds nothing like how it sounded 10, 11 years ago. I mean, it was deep, but it was flat. I wasn't pronouncing the words properly. You know, I wasn't singing from the diaphragm. I was singing from my throat. I was singing very nasally. And I've still got those recordings archived somewhere. And I was scrolling through my Facebook, and you know when you get those memories that pop up on your newsfeed for like from 8 or 9 years ago. This particular one came up, and it was the very first song that I recorded, the very first cover. It was called Let It Snow. And oh my gosh, I could not believe how terrible I sounded. I was like, what the heck is this? And every time I hear it, I'm like, ugh, I just want to cringe a little bit. But then I'm looking forward to my voice maturing even more. It's definitely matured over the last 10 years, but I'm looking forward to the next 10 years.
Yeah, you're still young.
I know.
So in order to kind of pursue that dream, that career in music, you did something which might seem a little bit counterintuitive. You moved from London down to Somerset.
I did, yes. And now you're probably going to ask the question, why? I get that all the time. And yeah, I'll be happy to answer that for you. Now, the truth is, I didn't want to go to university. I wanted to take a gap year and then see where I can go after that. I was really close with my friends at college. We were all musical, you know, we all do music. And we had a very close bond. Every afternoon after lessons, we would sort of come to the music room, do some recording, just mess around, or just chill out with each other. I didn't want to let that go. They were like my brothers. So I didn't want to let go of that. So I didn't want to go to university, but my parents were insistent that I go. So I had a look around for some courses. The first course I applied for was a media course at Anglia Ruskin University near Cambridge. So I applied for that initially, and then my teacher said, Marvin, you know, I know you're talented in media, that's a given, but your passion is music. You have such a gift. It would be such a shame for you to waste that gift on doing something that you don't particularly want to do. And then it dawned on me, and I said to them, you know what, you're right, actually. So I changed my UCAS application, and I looked for all the music performance and production courses all over the country. But one of them was Bath Spa University. And I had a conversation with them. They didn't feel that my grades were up to scratch at the time, but they saw my potential, and they offered me an interview for a similar course that they were running in Weston-super-Mare in Somerset. So I travelled down to Weston-super-Mare.
So the first time you'd been there?
Yeah, for the very first time before I actually moved there, and went to the campus where everything was taking place, had my interview, I got accepted. All I had to do was get the grades. I got the grades. And I was getting ready to move. Now, there was obviously my dad in particular, you know. Have you ever heard of empty nest syndrome?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think he had a very bad case of that when I was getting ready to leave. He didn't want me to go to Western initially. He wanted me to go somewhere closer. So we had quite a few times where we were at loggerheads with each other, trying to, like, you know, trying to see it from both sides of the argument. But I knew that this is what I had to do. So I came down to Weston in September 2014, but it was the very first time that I saw the sea.
Ever?
No, not ever, but like...
The sea in Weston?
Yeah, the sea in Weston, because where I looked for my accommodation, I wasn't aware that I was going to be living right on the seafront.
Right.
When I came for my interview, all I saw was the town centre and the campus, and then we went back to Bath for the rest of the day.
Did you know that it was a coastal town?
No, actually. I was like, whoa! I could not believe it. It was so wonderful.
Did you not, like, Google Maps the place before coming?
I saw pictures of it in their prospectus.
Yeah.
But I wasn't actually sure it was actually going to be on the seafront. I thought it was going to be somewhere more inland. But it really surprised me, though. It was so nice. It was a nice sunny day. I felt the sea air. It felt like I was in Spain or something. The sea breeze was so fresh. There was a lot of vibrance. I think it was there was lots of dancing in the streets, and there was lots of street performers there. And I was walking to my house on the seafront, and my mum said a prayer for me, as she does. And then she we had a little cry, and then she and my sister finally went back home on the coach. And I was like, wow, so this is it. This is it. That first night I slept in Western, my ears were sort of ringing, because after spending like 18 years living in London, you're so used to hearing all the noise, like motorbikes and ambulances rushing down the road at 3 a.m. in the morning, or something else going on, arguing across the street, the occasional gunshot. So first night in Western was completely peaceful, and I was like, my goodness, this is nice. And then it was then that I fell in love with Somerset. Not to mention that the people here are 9 times out of 10, most of them are so beautiful, such nice people. I walk down the seafront or walk in town, people come up to you and say good morning, they ask how you are, and we get talking. Even people I don't know, you can have a conversation with them. Just, they're so easily approachable, and they won't ridicule you or tell you to bugger off or anything like that.
Now, you're not in your sort of trademark bow tie and kind of formal get up.
No, not right now.
This evening.
This is my casual one.
Whenever I picture you, you know, just going to the shops in Western, it's, you know, you're wearing a hat. You've got your tux on. And so, I don't know, am I wrong?
You are kind of correct, I would say. I don't wear the bow tie, but I do try and keep a smart appearance. So I do like wear, it depends really. Like most of the time I try and keep it smart casual. So I'll wear like a long shirt and jeans, and then like just like smooth shoes. But I always wear the hat, you see.
It's part of the look, though, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Even when I'm walking to gigs in my suit and tie and hat, people know it's me. It's like, oh, that's Marvin, rocking up in his suit. You're looking fab, son. Looking fantastic. I'm like, oh, thank you.
When you first moved, did you immediately start thinking, okay, well, where can I perform nearby?
I've just been blessed, to be honest with you, because I didn't really think of that, to be honest. I was just finding my feet in Western, you know, finding my feet with new people, trying to fit in with the uni community. And one of the things that my course actually had, which I'll always be thankful for, is that every Thursday they would take us out. There's a great guy called Oz Carhill. He would always take us out on the Thursday to a venue somewhere in Somerset. And he would host like a college gig. So like every college person that would come in the van would get up and perform, be it a solo act or a duo or a full proper band. And every time we would play there, you know, I would get contacts from people, you know, saying, oh, Marvin, oh, I really love your voice. You know, give us a number and we'll be in touch. So it was that building up that sort of community was very, very nice. We went all over the place. We went to the Bear Inn in Western. I can't remember what it's called. There was a lovely music bar we went to in Burnham-on-Sea. And then we went to the Esplanade in Watchet in West Somerset, which was right by the harbour, which I thought was lovely. It was my first time going down to West Somerset. It was gorgeous. Right by the station, actually, the old station.
What's your favourite place to perform, then?
My favourite place? Ooh. I do not know, if I'm honest. Those that I don't know, there's quite a bit of Somerset that I've yet to sort of, you know, discover, if you know what I mean. So I've done, like, the northern parts of Somerset and some of the southwestern parts, too. One of the biggest in Somerset is the Playhouse, which is in Western. So I'm happy to say I've done the Playhouse quite a few times, and it's a great atmosphere in there, great crowd. Another place that I really enjoyed playing was, oh yes, I just remembered now. Have you ever heard of a place called Braz? It's in Taunton. It's underneath the Castle Bow.
What's that like?
Oh, it's beautiful. It's like a proper restaurant. And there's a story to this one, actually. There's a story to this. So I was busking in the late summer in 2018 or 2019. And the security guard who works outside Braz saw me from across the street. He said, oh, come over here. And I was like, what's up? Am I too loud? He's like, no. You're fantastic. Play outside here and, you know, entertain us. So I was like, okay, fine, I'll do that. So I set up across the road, set up my gear, started playing in front of this huge, beautiful restaurant. And so many people got up, they brought their food and then chairs and tables outside, sat outside and heard me perform. And they were throwing in £10 notes, £20 notes. And I was like, what? This is fantastic. The chef was highly impressed and he was like, you got to get him in as soon as possible. And then from there on in, I did quite a few gigs with them. And it was one of the most beautiful atmospheres. So nice and calm. Everyone's respectful. Whilst they're eating their food, they're not coming up, you know, drunk, you know, trying to like, you know, harass you or, you know,
make stupid requests.
Interrupts your, yeah, your, don't get me started on stupid requests, man. I think the worst one I had was when I was singing jazz, right? You know, in my usual, you know, attire, suit and tie and hat. And one of the guys who was listening to me all night, he says, oh, great job, mate. Do you sing any Foo Fighters? And I was like, huh? Foo Fighters? And I was like, come on, man. I just laughed it off and I said, no, I don't. But in my mind, I was like, come on. Did you not hear what I was just singing just now?
That's your best Somerset accent as well.
Yeah. I tell you what, it's growing on me, the Somerset accent, because sometimes when I'm out, I end up pronouncing my R's like R.
Yeah.
Just like unconsciously.
You're picking it up.
I am picking it up. How was the accent? Was it good?
I mean...
that said it all for me.
As a new feature for this season, we're showcasing Somerset's musical talent with tracks from local acts in each podcast. This episode, there was only one choice for our guest musician, Marvin himself. Taken from his latest album, Marvin Monnikay's Lockdown Hootenanny, this is his 2021 single, That Face.
That face, that wonderful face, it shines and it glows all over the place. And how I love to watch it change expressions. Each look becomes the price of my possessions. I love that face, that wonderful face, my dear, it just isn't fair. You must forgive the way that I stare. But never will these eyes behold a sight that could replace that face, that face, that face. I love those eyes, those lips, and that fabulous smile. She laughs and spring goes right out of style. And never will these eyes behold a sight that could replace that face, that face, that face. Such grace, your place, my place, that face. I want to kiss that lovely face.
In 2016, you took part in the TV show The Voice.
That is correct, yes.
Who convinced you to go for that, given that you had, you know, you'd previously had a shot at a couple of, you know, TV talent shows in the past? Why did you kind of think, right, I'm back and going to have another go at this?
It's funny that, because when I was in college, I decided to go for The Voice, and... But this is when my parents were saying, no, my dad in particular was saying, no, Marvin, don't go on any TV show. But I tried to do it behind their back. So I signed the form, and I signed it. I forged their signature, and I printed it off, signed everything. I was like, yeah, I'm ready to go. And then I went to all the way from college in Essex, all the way to Wembley Stadium, on the other side of London. I got there and I got cold feet. I thought, nah, I can't do this. I was like, nah. So I got on the train back home. So fast forward now to 2016, when I was at uni, my tutor, a great guy, great saxophonist called Paul Raymond, he called me up whilst I was at home. He said, Marvin, there's some scouts from The Voice here at uni. You should come along and, you know, just try your luck. And I was like, okay, there's no harm in that. And I felt, you know, that there was nothing to lose. So I thought, you know what, I'll just do it. They'll probably just say no anyway. So I sang To Make You Feel My Love in my sort of jazzy fashion. And much to my surprise, I got a call back for another audition in Cardiff. And I was like, oh, okay. So I went to Cardiff. Did another audition where I met a great singer called Tobias Robertson, who was from Wales. And we got talking, and he got through the next year after me. But I got through that audition. And then sooner after, I was invited to London to do a few trial auditions where they try different songs, try different sort of styles, not styles, but different treatments, if you will, of like how fast it's gonna be, or how slow it's gonna be, or major or minor, and stuff like that. Now, I had a few songs up my sleeve myself. Being an arranger, I arranged like a big band version of Wonderwall by Oasis, and I thought that was pretty good actually, and they enjoyed it. But they have the final say. So in the end, we both agreed on Sing, Sing, Sing by Louis Prima. And that was the actual audition. So there were a few things to sort of go through in terms of rehearsal and making sure that everything was up to scratch in terms of performance. I had a great guy called Mark, who's my vocal coach for that audition, giving me a few pointers, and it was my choice to incorporate the tap dancing in that as well. But the thing is, what was funny about that, they don't really tell you whilst you're doing all this if you're actually going to make it to the actual TV audition. They don't tell you that until about a few months later. So I wasn't sure if I was wasting my time down there or if I was going to actually go through and actually make a shot of this. So I was in a bit of limbo for a while. And it was quite a bit unnerving, to be honest with you, at times. But around about October 2015, I got the call that I was going to go to Manchester, Salford in Manchester, to record my audition. Now, at that time, my grandfather on my father's side had passed away a few months earlier, back in the summer. And I was considering not going to this audition. But my dad and my mum were like, Marvin, you know, this is your thing. Go for it and just do it. you know, it's a shame we can't be with you, but we'll be there in spirit. So I went to that audition all on my own, sadly. But it was a lovely experience. I met a lot of lovely people who kept me company as well. And the thing was just, the audition was, it was, you know, I didn't get any turns. It probably wasn't meant to be.
Was it the first time that you'd performed in front of cameras?
That was the very first time. First national TV debut. first performance in front of the cameras, properly.
Can you remember what was going through your head while you were singing?
Yes. So the thing that I can remember was making sure, because I was wearing tap shoes, the floor was very slippery. So I had to sort of clump my way onto the stage, I had to creep on to make sure that I didn't slip. Because I knew if I went down, that was it, game over. I didn't want that to happen. So luckily I kept my cool and that didn't happen, thankfully. It did happen before the audition, though. If you watch it back, I think you can watch it back on YouTube, I think.
It is on YouTube, yeah.
Yes, but I'm talking about the entire thing where I'm talking to Marvin Humes, who happens to be Marvin as well, which everyone found hilarious. I was showing him my tap dancing moves in the green room, and I slipped on the floor and I fell. And that was all on camera, and they showed that clip as well. I was like, you cheeky sods. But it was it was a lot of fun.
You're obviously disappointed not to get any turns. And then the next time you went down the TV route with Britain's Got Talent again, you did that as a duo.
Yes. Well, when you say disappointed, I actually wasn't disappointed, actually. Because when you sit and think about it, it actually went in my favour. Now, I'll always be thankful to The Voice for their advice and just all the crew just being so nice, even the judges as well. But the fact is, you know, I did the best I could, and you can see on their faces that, especially Will I Am, like, he regretted not turning. So the joke is sort of on them, really, that the fact that none of them turned and a lot of them regretted not turning. So the fact that I was able to go there and do my thing and, you know, still be here and not chained to any weird record deal, it's great. I have no regrets of not, you know, making it further. Everything happens for a reason. That's what I'm basically saying. And sure. Had I not, if I went further on The Voice, I might not have got to BGT at all, where I think we made a bigger impact, I believe.
So tell us about the Rat Packers. How did that start?
Well, a long time ago. About 5 years ago, I was singing at a pub called The Imperial one Christmas, and Dennis, my friend and musical partner, co-Rat Packer, if you will, was also on the bill to be playing that month as well. And he came to see me with his wife, Tina, and he loved what I was singing. He loved my voice, and he really wanted to work with me. It took about a year or so to get things off the ground. And when things got off the ground, it was really good at first. There was actually three of us to begin with. We were called the Imperialists after the Imperial Pub. And we did a mixture of jazz, soul, and sort of like Motown sort of stuff. Our first gig was actually a charity fundraiser for Somerset Cancer Care. And they had a shop on the Western High Street, and they agreed to let us use their power if we sang for them whilst people were putting money in their tin. I think we raised about £200 for them that night. And it was really nice. Things were going very well. We had our first gig at the Imperial. That went very well. And then soon after, we had a gig on the Grand Pier, where we raised £2,500 for West Haven School. But then came the time where we wanted to go for BGT the first time, Britain's Got Talent the first time, and we missed that opportunity. We sent them a video of what we do, and we heard nothing back. But the producer of the time, a guy called Alec, he left that show the next year, and he invited us all to do a audition for a show, like a sort of a Pitch Perfect show on Sky One. Now, Dennis and I were completely thrilled about that. So we recorded this song. We were beginning to record this song, and basically the third singer thought this wasn't feasible, so he just upped and left on the night we were due to record this video for Sky One, and that left us very upset. So it was very sudden. It was a huge blow to us both for quite a few weeks. We used to meet up every Wednesday and sing together, rehearse and write songs and devise things together. And it was some of the sounds that were coming out of that studio were just so wonderful. And we had some great things, but again, some things are just meant to be. Some things happen for a reason. But regardless, Dennis and I started meeting up with each other still, and we started to look more into the sort of jazz sort of medley show. Now, see, back in the 50s and 60s, on American television, especially the variety shows, you'd often have guest artists come in and they would sing medleys of songs together. They were sort of like mishmash songs together. But the way they did them and the way that they were orchestrated was so clever and so fantastic. And me and Dennis, I remember us watching these old shows in awe, and we really wanted to recapture that, because I think that's something that's been sort of lost in today's entertainment world, and we wanted to try and bring that back, bring back the humor. And then we started watching the Rat Pack. Now, there's several videos of them, of the Rat Pack: Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., Joey Bishop and Peter Lawford, all performing on stage at the Sands Hotel in Las Vegas. And we would watch these shows and we just laugh. You know, some of it is a bit politically incorrect, but, you know, it was all out of love. And we wanted to sort of try and bring that back. So our initial show was called The Rat Pack Review, where we would sing songs on our own, sing songs together, and add a bit of comedy, and then take them around to the pubs and clubs and holiday parks. And then BGT came up again. So they were holding auditions at the Sovereign Shopping Centre in Weston-super-Mare, at a disused shop. So it was like a blank space inside the shopping centre. And I remember us going there in our hats and ties and suits, as we do. We made quite an impact the second we walked into the room, really. We lined up in the queue outside the shop, and it said, "What's your name of the act?" And I said, "We can't go as Rat Pack Review." So I just put in the Rat Packers. Now, Dennis wasn't happy with that name at first, but I was like, "What else? There's no other name." So we call ourselves the Rat Packers. And so we went into the shop, and we, again, very similar to what I've been through before, where like there's a camera and there's like a producer and another producer and another producer. And we sang a song, a medley of songs, actually, like classic big band songs all mashed up together. And we made quite an impression. We were shortlisted for one of the best in the entire Southwest. One of the things that was caught on the camera, so whilst we were singing, outside on the window, people gathered in and then they started cheering and clapping for us as we finished. And I was like, whoa, okay. I think the producers liked that.
So then you ended up going to the actual show itself.
Yes, it took again, waiting, months and months of waiting. And then they expect you to send videos over of, you know, what you do, your routines, your sort of like, they expect you to send over like a whole smorgasbord of photos of like, you know, your heroes and all that sort of thing. But it was all part of the process, and it was worth it in the end. When we finally got the call to go to the London Palladium to perform in front of over 2,000 people, I remember when I got the news on my phone, I was screaming down the street. I was like, yes! London, here we come. And it was one of the most great joys.
Is that the biggest audience that you've played to?
I don't... Probably is. Do you know how much seats are in the Royal Festival Hall? Because I've played there as well.
I mean, it's one of the two, isn't it?
Yeah. So I would say it's definitely one of the biggest. And you definitely hear it once you go in as well. So on the day of the actual televised audition, I came down with a cold. And I thought, oh, this is bad timing, terrible timing. But I had to push through it. So I just, you know, dosed myself up with lots of vitamin C tablets and hot tea and oranges. And I met a lot of lovely people, actually. It was all, you know, we were all rooting for each other. We were all supportive of each other, even though it was a competition. It was the atmosphere was healthy. You know, there was no one trying to be better than anyone else. You know, it was all like, you know, very one, that one happy family, if you will.
Yeah. Do you get to watch the other acts as well?
Sadly not, no. I mean, we get to speak to them because we all get put into one room.
Because you're all behind, yeah.
Yeah, but then you can't see them, sadly. So once you go, that's it, you're gone.
That's a shame.
Yeah, but then they do come back though, so, you know. But when we got called up, it was time to go. I was like, yeesh, uh-oh, it's time to go. They took us out of the holding room, then we walked to the stage door of the London Palladium, then we walked backstage, and we heard this huge, huge roar of applause. And the reason why I'm saying that is because it frightened Dennis and I. We both looked at each other at the same time. We were like, whoa! And we had to sort of calm ourselves down for a little bit. We had to sort of take a few deep breaths. And because it was like, at the time, it was huge for us. So we didn't want to mess this up, especially me with my cold as well.
What's more nerve-wracking, singing to the backs of four chairs or singing to judges that are actually kind of looking at you?
Well, the nerves will always be there. You know, when people say, oh, I never get nervous, they're lying. Especially performers, you know, everyone wants to do well. And if you want to do well, those nerves will probably come even more because you have good intentions. But the best thing is how you deal with those nerves. And once I came out on stage, I was, well, once we got going, we were in our element. It was fantastic, phenomenal. The atmosphere was wonderful. They were all up on their seats. And one of the things that they didn't show was that for like the best part of like half a minute, the crowd were going, golden buzzer, golden buzzer, golden buzzer. And I was like, wow, this is phenomenal. We looked at each other. And they're shouting golden buzzer. But sadly, they had used all their golden buzzers on other acts. So, but you know.
Well, you still made it through and got to perform in a more sort of choreographed setup with the semi-finals as well, didn't you?
Yes, we did. Our actual goal was to get to past the first round. So to get to the live semi-final was a huge, huge achievement, a huge honour. My only concern was that this time we had to use in-ears, like the in-ear headphones that, you know, a lot of these artists use. And my left in-ear towards the end of the song was falling out. And I was scared that I was going to go out of time. You wouldn't see that on the video. I came across pretty chilled, but in my mind I was like, oh no. Just keep the time. And then you'll be all right. But yeah, it was nice to be working on. It was nice to see the world of TV, especially live television as well, and to see how all these things work in terms of choreographing and staging and the lighting. And it was tiring, but you know, BGT was definitely a huge, huge thrill, and this is one of the great highlights of my career so far.
So I want to talk a little bit about the last 12 months, I suppose, where you know, performing live has not been an option, but you still kept really busy, in particular releasing an album. Many of the songs on there are your own compositions as well. How long had that been in the pipeline? When did you start kind of thinking, okay, I need to work on my own material and build up an album?
Well, the album, The Young Man with the Old Soul, was conceived about, it's basically been about 5 years in the making, actually. People kept asking me, oh, Marvin, you're great. You should bring out an album. When are you bringing out an album? I was like, yeah, I'll bring it out next year. And then soon after, every year became next year. Every year was a different vibe, different name, different title, different cover art. I've got several like covers still of like the different names that I was going to call this album and everything. And lockdown definitely gave me, as hard as it was, definitely gave me the opportunity and the time to actually invest in this album and to actually just get it done once and for all, which I'm very, very thankful for.
And it's not just, again, the typical standards. You've written songs in there that are inspired by the West Country as well, haven't you?
Yes, one of my songs that I do pride myself on, Wandering in Western, which is a great song, I believe. You often hear songs that are written about New York and London and Paris and San Francisco, thanks to Tony Bennett. But I thought it would be nice to give something back to the town that really gave my musical career a boost. And that town was Weston-super-Mare. So I really thought of a great idea to write a song that highlights all the positive things about Weston-super-Mare and all the positive things it has to offer, like the donkey ride, the Ferris wheel, the Grand Pier, the stunning landscape, the sea air.
Are there any other songs about Weston that you know of?
There's one song that I came across by the Wurzels about Weston-super-Mare.
Oh, okay. Slightly different.
The sunny Weston-super-Mare, something like that. But it was about Weston-super-Mare by the Wurzels.
The Wurzels are pretty much Somerset royalty.
They are, absolutely.
From a musical perspective. So you're in the same category as them.
I wasn't really a fan of them before, but then I was walking home from a gig once and they were playing on the Grand Pier because like they play there every year now, like normally. And they were, the song that we were playing was, I am a cider drinker. I drinks it all of the day. I was like, what? Ooh-ah-ooh-ah-ray. I was like, wow, this is actually really good. And I've been following them ever since.
You need to arrange a jazz version of I Am a Cider Drinker.
I wouldn't say no to that. I wouldn't say no to that at all.
I think that could work.
I'll have to see about that. I'm always up for a challenge.
The other thing I think that you've also retained, again, you mentioned the Rat Pack and the sort of entertainment and comedy element of that. Your intro to Pennies from Heaven the album references the West Country accent and how you don't understand it, which I think is a really cute way to bring up or to introduce a song.
Yeah, because again, going back to the shows of the 50s and 60s, where a lot of these shows, there was always banter between the guests and the hosts. And so, and even in recorded duets as well. For example, if you research Frank Sinatra with Pearl Bailey, or Louis Armstrong with Ella Fitzgerald, or Louis Prima and Keeley Smith, there was always some sort of banter before the song, and even during the song as well, which I always thought was such a great thing. It's so spontaneous and so connecting on a personal level. And I think, again, that's a lost art, which I think needs to be brought back in some aspects. So the whole West Country thing with my friend Adam in the Hap, we recorded that at his house in Exeter. And we sort of made pokes fun at the whole Devon accent and the whole Devon thing, which I thought was very, very nice and very funny. A lot of my friends from that area appreciated that. And there's a line where he sings, "There'll be pennies from Devon." And I'm like, watch it. For you and me. One of my favorite duets to date, man. It's a great, great, great duet.
Again, even more recently than that, we were talking a little bit just before we sort of started recording about the single that you've released this month, well, in March, which is very of the time in terms of the subject matter.
Mm.
Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, so the song came out on March the 12th. It's a song that I'm quite proud of for many things, mainly because it took me 2 weeks to write and it took me 2 weeks to produce. It's a summary of how I and many people, the majority of people in this country and probably across the world, have been feeling about the entire coronavirus lockdown and the pandemic and the effects it's having on our physical health, our wealth, our mental health. And it's called It Won't Be Long. And it's a song that offers hope and optimism during what has been the darkest period in our modern history. It talks about the effects of the coronavirus lockdown and having hope for the day for when restrictions are eased for good, hopefully, and we can get back to the things that we love, the things that we miss, and let's face it, the things that we all took for granted once in our lives.
What was it that kind of prompted you to start on that?
My only regret was that I didn't write this song a little bit earlier, but for me, it was the roadmap. Whether that roadmap will go to plan, nobody knows. But having a glimmer of hope, and with the days getting lighter and things brightening up again, you know, it feels like there's light at the end of the tunnel. And I just felt the need to sort of incorporate all these feelings that I had into this song. If you listen to the song, the first verse says that I have a joy that's unspoken. It can hardly wait to spread once these shackles, meaning the lockdown, are broken, are finally gone. The joy that we have that's been contained in our hearts for so long, you know, we want to give it to people, not just on the stage, but on the people that we meet in the street. Being able to see people, being able to hug each other without fear of catching anything, or, you know, being able to entertain people without fear of being arrested or catching anything once again.
It's really interesting, the parallels, actually. You mentioned earlier on about, you know, singing in church and being a Christian, but there's some strong themes that are actually, you know, that work both ways in terms of like the Christian viewpoint of this world being something that is to be endured, and then there is hope at the end of that.
Yes. So in another part of the song, it talks about being on your own, especially for those who live on their own. It's very, very hard these last 12 months, especially for myself as well. But the song talks about having hope, as I said. And one of the verses, it talks about, you know, being alone and just weeping. But it indirectly references one of my favorite verses from the Bible. And it says, "Weeping may endure for a night, but joy comes in the morning." And that might not necessarily mean that things will be okay, but it does mean that there's always something to look forward to as the sun rises. And it's yours to go out and sort of take ownership of, and to sort of grab and to own, and to create the opportunities you want to do, whether we're in lockdown or not.
So obviously the lyrics of It Won't Be Long, you know, reference lockdown and talk about how it's been a trying time. How much of that is your personal experience?
I would say 50% of it, especially in the first two verses. There's been lots of times where I'd be sat in my room, you know, just upset at the state of the world, just upset at how things are going. You know, one minute, you know, I had all this income locked in and then it was just taken away from me within the blink of an eye. And keeping my head above water, as I have now, has been very difficult. But you adapt. As the famous lyric goes, you probably know, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. And that's what we've all been doing over these last 12 months. Has it been easy? No, it hasn't. But it's been very creative. And I'm very proud to say that, you know, I like to think of myself as a survivor. Because the truth is, a lot of people, a lot of professional musicians and entertainers I know have given up completely. They've had to change careers completely. And as somebody who is, you know, really starting to sort of go for the extra mile, 2020 was due to be my busiest year. And I was not prepared to allow this lockdown, this pandemic, be the death of my career. I was not prepared to have that at all. So I got creative. When the going gets tough, the tough get going. They get going, they get creative as well. So the very first day of lockdown, the very first Sunday, happened to be Mother's Day, and I started doing a live stream called Melody Time with Marvin. It was the Mother's Day special. I sang for about 2 hours, and it drew quite a crowd, actually. So I decided to do it once every week, and then I then decided to do it twice every week, Friday and Saturday. So it gives them a real... The people who do watch, it gives them a real sense of, you know, this live music, despite the fact that they can't go out. They can still hear live music, they can still be entertained. And from doing these shows, I've been able to earn money as well, which has actually helped pay the bills, keep a roof over my head, which has been very overwhelming in a nice way. Very nice indeed. And also, I'm very happy to say as well that over these three lockdowns, I've produced three albums. Now, the first one I released on my birthday, October 30th, and I've got a new one coming out, hopefully, in a few weeks' time, April 9th. It's called Marvin Monique's Lockdown Hootenanny, which is a... yeah. I've got that. That's coming out on April 9th. It's a semi-live album full of 11 standards, some of my favourite standards, with my quartet. So Jim Pullen on bass, Richard Llewellyn on guitar, Phil Haller on the drums, and myself on the vocals and trumpet as well. So that comes out very soon. I also produced another live album. This album was actually recorded back in 2018. It was a live concert I did at St. Paul's Church in Weston-super-Mare with a full big band. I had that recorded for posterity, and lockdown gave me the opportunity to revisit this recording and actually remix it and release it, and it sounds fantastic. I'm hoping to bring that out later this year, at the very least, probably early next year if not possible. But then I've got those two coming out soon as well. And I've got a fourth album planned as well. So all these things, again, although I haven't been able to gig and work like to my normal capacity, I am thankful for the one thing I'm thankful for about lockdown is that it's given me the opportunity to revisit the recording side of things, the songwriting, the arranging, all the things that are also very important too, and a lot of the things that you don't often get time for when you're gigging like three or four times a week normally.
Well, Marvin, we are anticipating being able to see you perform live at some point, hopefully later on this year. We will see how the roadmap goes. But before then, where can people find out more about you and about your music? What's the best place to check out?
So I've got multiple links. So if you want to see more of me, you can go on my website. That's www.marvinmuoneke.com. or you can follow me on my Instagram. That's Marvin, M-U-O-N-E-K-E, official. And on my Facebook page, where you can see my medley time with Marvin broadcasts every Friday and Saturday until lockdown's over. Who knows when that will be. That's on facebook.com/ Marvin, M-U-O-N-E-K-E, singer, Marvin Monique singer. And also, I've got songs, albums, or my album out, The Young Man with the Old Soul, on Spotify and Apple Music. And all my singles are on there as well, on all streaming platforms as well. So you can follow me and listen for as many times as you wish.
Marvin, it's been great talking to you again. Thank you so much for coming back and sharing your Somerset story.
Thank you very much, and I hope to speak to you again. Hopefully I'll get the chance to come down your way and perform around your area.
That would be amazing.
When things are. But until then, look after yourself, take care, and thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Somerset Stories. If you liked it, you can subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to get in touch, you can find us on social media at Somerset Stories or email hello@somersetstories.com. Music on all Somerset Stories productions is created by Jazar. You can be found at betterwithmusic.com. See you next time.